Hello and welcome to Someone Should Make This, a show where we do the hard part of coming up with great video game ideas and offer them up to the world. My name is Danish.
I'm Jeff.
I'm Dan.
And we got our very special guest today, Mike Bithell's joining us, creator of Thomas Was Alone and John Wick Hex. Hi, Mike. How's it going?
Not too bad. I just went for a walk through a deer park, which is the most British way to spend an afternoon ever.
Oh, that's great.
It's quite nice. It's fun.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's good. I'll see some deers. It's nice. Deers or deer? Plural of deer?
I think it's just deer.
Deers.
It's deer. Ooh. Yeah, oh, we already have a disagreement.
Is it really? It's moose, but...
I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I think it's just deer, but it might be deers. I don't know.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
what's your time been like now? Like, you know, after launching North Star Rising, you know, you got games out. Are you taking a break or are you like working on the next thing?
No, I'm working on the next thing. Yeah, I'm actually working on the next couple of things. Yeah, I don't know. My reaction to this whole situation for the last few months has been just to overwork. Like, and I it will hit me at some point. But yeah, no, I've just been keeping busy.
Oh my god. Yeah. Same here. In fact, there was an Onion article that just hit like a ton of bricks, whereas like, man, not sure why he thought most stressing period of his life would be his most productive. Yeah. But that's basically, yeah, just, hey, this is great. I could do so much things. And then it's like, oh man, it's a lot of mental pressure.
It
but,
is.
How's distributed work going? Like, is that actually working out pretty well in terms of like work from home stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we've always been work from home. We never got around to
actually
getting a physical print. Yeah, so our games have always been...
Oh, I actually
our teams have always been
that.
Distributed. Yeah, no, it's always been part of our thing. Every couple of years or so, I'd get it into my head that I wanted to have, like, you know, a studio with, like, a vinyl sign. So we'd, like, go and check out some places and just the... Effectively, it always just we always realize basically like we can just pay our staff more if we don't have to pay for an office for them to be in, and that I always came down on that side of the fence. But yeah, you just have to work around it. But so no, like the distributor thing's been fine for us, but like I guess it's all the other stuff outside of that. What's really weird is there's a lot of like there's a lot of benefits to being a work from home team in a world where most people don't work from home. But then when everyone starts working from home, it gets challenging in lots of different ways. Like there's lots of benefits to that.
Oh, interesting.
A lot of people you feel like you're playing like a cheat mode, and then obviously everyone's then in the same boat, and that and also dealing with all of this stress and all of these awful situations. So we've been luckier than most. We were already kind of prepared for it in a way, which was good. I'm interested, like how's it been generally kind of on your side of the fence in kind of a bigger studio? Like, cause I presume that you're working from home as well, right?
Yeah. So our work from home has actually been pretty good as well. Like we shipped our latest game all work from home, and I mean, yeah, same thing. There were growing pains, but I think overall, and Dan, you can speak to this, there's definitely some challenges specifically with like motion capture.
Wow, yeah.
But other than that, it's actually been, to me, surprisingly smooth. It's kind of great, actually. I mean, I get to go downstairs and have, you know, lunch with my family and that sort of thing. At this point, you know, a few months in now, I do miss the studio. Like, I miss the kind of creative reinforcement of walking around and seeing really cool things people are working on. But other than that, yeah, I think it's been pretty cool.
I think for me, like it's an extra challenge for me because I have a 4-year-old who's running around the house all the time, which is always challenging. But the other thing I miss is just like the random talks in the hallway, that sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I'll walk by Danish's desk, see something cool he's working on, talk through it, kind of come up with some ideas and stuff. So that kind of spontaneity is pretty hard to come by now. But yeah, otherwise it's been like remarkably smooth once I was able to get my hands on a webcam, which were in high demand there for a little while.
Yeah. They all sold out, right? Like everyone, no one can get a webcam.
Yeah,
right.
And it's crazy. Still pretty rough out there. I was just looking on Amazon today, and like the best webcams you can get are kind of those like bottom of the basket bargain ones that you're not sure are actually going to work because you've never heard of the brand name, but they're only $35, so I don't know, maybe you're all right,
worth a shot.
So what do you guys been playing, anything cool recently? I know me, Jeff, and Matt, who's not here this week, We've been playing so much Fall Guys. Mike, did you get a chance to check this out?
I've not played it. I've got several mates who worked on it, so I should probably play it because I feel bad. Oh, really? I do need to get to it. It's it looks amazing. And the way it's blown up as well, it's definitely like, that's a big game already, right, in terms of the audience.
So smart. Their rollout, I'm just so in awe of like the strategy and like the smart way they did it. Like, they sent it out to the influencers. They got some hype going like right before. And then the PlayStation Plus thing was like just genius. Yeah. I mean, it's basically like the Rocket League model, right?
It is. It feels like that. Yeah.
Everyone's kudos. They did an awesome job. I mean, then the game itself is so good that we can't stop playing.
Yeah, the accessibility alone is great. My girlfriend, who is very much into platformers but nothing 3D, has been loving it and working the camera like a pro. She got in second place on Hexagon last night, which Dan and Danish, you guys know that's something.
It's a challenge. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Nice.
And so we've also all been playing Ghost of Tsushima, so we could talk a little bit about that too. How far are you in that, Mike?
I slowed down because I got really into all the side quests, so I cleared the very first of it's three islands, right? So I cleared the first of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first of them I'm done on, and then I'm probably like, I don't know, 5 to 10 hours but into the next one, but I'm playing all the side quests. I'm playing it slow. Yeah. I'm savoring that game because it's lovely.
I'm probably not even that far. Yeah. I'm still working on the first island. I think I'm close to the ending the first island, but yeah. I am playing, I don't know about you, I'm playing exclusively in the Kurosawa mode.
Really?
With Japanese audio and subtitles.
Do you get all the cues? Do you get, like, I tried it for a bit and I got really frustrated that, like, technically I think you get all the cues, but, like, can you actually play that and feel good about, I guess you must if you're absolutely playing all the way through? Okay.
Yeah, cool. Absolutely. We talked a little bit of this, like, a couple weeks ago, but basically there's an audio cue, which I'm using more than anything else, and it actually helps me so much that I almost don't even need to look for it. I can just hear that chime and know that someone's attacking. So it's been great. The only thing that was a little funny was there's a mission where you have to look for a very specific, like a color flower, like a violet flowers. Mm. And obviously I can't do that. But when I get around to it, I don't know if this does this normally, just in this mode, but the main character says, "Oh, violet flowers." And I'm like, "Oh, good." Well, so someone thought about that.
Yeah, and I think especially the audio stuff, that inspired the blind pitch we did a couple weeks ago, right? So we did talk about that. So Mike, to your point about like moving super slow through the story, getting all the side quests and stuff, I did the exact same thing. I probably put in like 10 to 15 hours just in that first area. And it was only when I was about to go to that first castle, Kaneda, that I realized I could zoom the map out. And I realized I was only in the first third of it. And it kind of scared me a little bit.
You thought you were like towards the end game.
Well, I knew I wasn't towards the end game because I hadn't gotten past an Act 1 title screen. But at the same point, I thought this was the island. And that was what I was going to be playing in, just back and forth. So I was very happy. But I finished the game and ended up doing the whole platinum trophy thing because those side quests are so interesting, especially the mythic quests, which Danish was referencing. Those those are the highlight of the game to me by far, not just because of like the set pieces that they include, but without going into specifics, in that second section of the island they start incorporating different objectives into those mythic quests. So it's not just like go from point A to point B to point C. It's kind of involving you more with the idea of war and the idea of factions, which I really appreciated.
Well, Danish, you need to hurry up and finish it because I'm borrowing your copy when you're done. And like right now, I just got to wait.
Exactly. Physical media, baby.
Yeah. I was wondering why you bought it physical. It surprised me.
No, so me and Dan were talking about this the other day, and this is kind of a funny thing. Like, growing up, me and my friends, like, we wouldn't be allowed to buy that many games. We would buy like maybe one or two games a year. And so we would all get together and coordinate what games we would ask our parents to buy.
Nice.
And then we would all lend them to each other. And this was so formative, so formative of my childhood, that to this day, when I buy something, I think, well, I got to buy it physical because I have to lend this out to someone, which of course almost never happens anymore. Yeah. But it's so ingrained in me that I still buy physical for like big games. Like obviously I buy a lot of digital games for like, you know, arcade style, mm-hmm. like small indie type games. But
and thank you for it.
Yeah, like, yes, absolutely. But yeah, the digital thing, man. And also like I'm really impatient and I know you could preload and stuff, but like, me running to the GameStop that's like 5 minutes away, driving back and installing it is like an hour faster than trying to download it. So that's another issue.
So how many games have you actually lent out to anybody in the last, I don't know, 10 years?
like two. Yeah, right. I think I let someone borrow a Spider-Man PS4 and like, I don't know, maybe like one other one.
Well, yeah. I admire your dedication.
So, but I know, it's not really a practical, but it's just that thing, it's just a hang-up I have in my head just from my youth that I can't. And that's why that one, like, borrowing, like, lending games to people, the PlayStation 4 ad, like, it spoke to me. Like, that I was the target audience yeah. for that specific marketing thing. But anyway, I want to talk about some of the specifics in Ghost. There's the game does so many great things, obviously, but, like, specific mechanics like the simple wind direction thing to tell you where to go, like it's just so elegant and so simple. I love touches like that, like this little idea. It does so many things because it ties into the aesthetics of it, because obviously the game has this very specific aesthetic of wind constantly blowing, like leaves constantly falling and grass swaying, and the way it's tied to an actual like gameplay mechanic of like telling you where to go, I thought was just so genius. Is there any mechanics that stuck out to you, to anybody, like that they appreciated?
Well, definitely that one, like specifically. And I think the thing that I didn't get until I actually played it, and even then I've only, like, I think it was about an hour before I did it, was realizing that it's passively available to you, that wind information as well. It's not, I was basically spamming that button in the same way as when I play any open world game. I'm constantly looking at the map, or I'm constantly like going back to the map screen and out. The moment I realized that I didn't need to press the button because I could just pick up like the slight fall on everything, like everything was affected by that, was mind blowing to me. Because that basically just on like amazing. A mechanic level, the fact that it's the entire screen real estate is constantly like that, you can read your environment and know where you're meant to go. 100%. And that it almost becomes subconscious, which is phenomenal. When that moment where you realize you just know it's over there and you're not actively actually, you're obviously still basing it on that information, but you're not, I'm instinctive with it now. That's really cool. I love the combat system in general, and specifically, same. I guess, the stances. I think that's so... Yes. I can't get over how much... I think that's the only reason, to be honest, I'm doing the side quests. So actually, I think the criticisms of the kind of the repetitive nature of the game are actually kind of quite fair on a lot of levels. So there's a lot of the same kind of missions over and over. They absolutely do interesting stuff with the mythic quests and stuff like that, but generally, it is that open world thing of doing the same loop. But that combat mechanic is so satisfying, and so satisfying to get good at and to master, that I've probably put more time and energy into just getting good. That, again, like about 15 hours into the game, realized that I was actively deciding not to do stealth because I just enjoyed the fantasy of that samurai fighting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the stances is really clever. That's a great way of adding depth to a combat system, which I don't think I've seen done that well before, like, because essentially it's four weapons, right? Like it would be like swapping weapons in a regular action game. That's really well done. The stances, I think that's the, and as they develop as well, and how those combos are unlocked, it's, that stuff's very clever to me. Sorry, I'll let someone else say one.
That's amazing. I actually want to kind of leapfrog off of both of those things. The wind direction and the passive nature of it struck me really strongly. I heard a lot of reviews and reviewers talking about the like really strong kind of cartoony wisps of wind. But to me, after the first, you know, couple hours of the game, I never saw those because I wasn't swiping. Mm. It was just the world kind of, I think it was someone on Kotaku or Polygon talking about how the whole world leans towards your objective. And there's, I want to liken that to level design, you know, where you see the light at the end of the hallway and you know you need to go in that direction. This is kind of the exact same thing, but it's done in a dynamic way, which is very subtly genius across the board.
I always wondered, it'd be interesting if, like, you know how on the map they have a lot of the question marks, and this is like a staple of, you know, open world, like Witcher and everything does this. Like, what it would have been like if there was no icons on the map at all, like no question marks or anything, but the winds would change to like your closest objective. Like that thing, that would be kind of cool.
If you want to play that way, you can unlock the wind direction techniques for finding more like collectible stuff, like the Inari shrines or the hop ads.
I did do that.
And then
yeah.
if you're wearing the traveler gear, you can also do the same thing with vanity items and flowers and different things like that.
Yeah, yeah. But you still have to actually choose that,
so
though.
You choose it, but it automatically cycles to the next one. So if you were like, I just want to go pick flowers, it would just continually point you to the nearest flower. So you could play very organically.
I see what you mean. Yeah, okay. That's kind of what I was saying, except I guess I was saying, like, what if it was every single thing all at once? It just gave you to the next one. But yeah, that's pretty cool. The other thing I want to mention is just like the following the animals, which is great. In like some of the older Assassin's Creed games, like you would follow the sea shanties, like there'd be little pieces of paper flying around, and even like you know, Spider-Man does like following the drones and stuff. But each one of those, it's sort of like a time trial. It's like a race where see if you can keep up. In this one, it's way more like just relaxing because I believe they wait for you, right?
Yeah, they do.
Or if they don't wait for you, it's much more like, you know, forgiving.
The yellow birds will circle until you start following them, and the foxes will actually sit still, and especially in tall grass areas, if you're still for too long, they'll hop so that you can see them. Like they bring in motion, and of course they're a different color than everything, so they really do a lot with that. And that was the second mechanic I wanted to talk about, which is for specific collectibles, different types of like particle beings will flock to them. So for instance, if you see a swarm of fireflies, you know that there is a vanity item, whether it's a headband or a hat or something like that. If you
see
a swarm, and if you see a swarm of butterflies, you know that there's a haiku there. And so the same thing with dragonflies. I can't remember what they swarm around, but it's super subtle and it's almost not noticeable with everything else going on, but it's there, and I really appreciate those things.
Yeah, you guys are going to make me buy this game before Danish is going to lend it to me. The only reason I'm waiting to get it lent to me is because I made this rule that I didn't want to buy any more games until I beat another one, because I'm bad at finishing games. And at the beginning of the COVID quarantine, like, I depression bought like $200 worth of games real quick. So, yeah.
This is a running theme. Like, Mike, I definitely want to hear your thoughts on this. Like, how do people have time to play games? Like, even Jeff, like, you play way more games than I do.
Obviously,
I have a family. That's a little bit different. But still, like, I can't rationalize spending 100 hours or 50 hours on one game, because I'd much rather spend 2 to 3 hours on 25 games or 10 different games. Like, I'm a sampler. I like to just get in, get out. I play 3 or 4 hours and I'm like, this is like one of the best games I've ever played. I'm going to move on. You know, it's like, that happens to me a lot. So how do you manage that, Mike? Do you sample a lot? Do you dig in? Do you like have a, are there games you're married to that you like Destiny, like you just kind of keep going back to, or how do you handle your kind of game playing?
So I don't do any kind of lifestyle games at all. Like, I think I played Destiny when the first Destiny came out just to like, I'm a sampler is the short version. Like, I'll go in, play like 3 or 4 hours, go, oh, I get this now. And obviously you're not getting the full picture, but like, you know, I get enough of kind of what this is. I feel like the classic kind of design, I've skimmed this for ideas, I can move on. Something like Ghost of Tsushima, honestly, that game, it's therapy. Like, it's just a nice place for me to go. And I'm a big, I like exploring. I like going hiking. You know, I like that in real life. And that's the closest a game's come to, like, I'm just going to go and see what's over that hill. There's no need to worry about why I'm doing that. That's a big deal to me. But no, generally, I always feel like I've not played enough games. And for me as well, what's interesting, because I'm in the indie space in terms of what I'm making, I don't really play many indie games. And it's a weird one where most of what I'm playing is AAA. I think partially because indie's a bit of a busman's holiday, which I've been told is only a British phrase. The Americans don't know what that means.
I don't know what that means.
So busman's holiday, it's the idea of like a guy who drives a bus going on a holiday feels like he's still at work. because he's on a bus. Holidays, like, it's describing, like, I wouldn't do that for fun because it's like work. And playing indie games, I'll sit and play them and I'll be like, oh, I can give some feedback here. Like, I can give these are my thoughts. I go into like review mode rather than whatever. And to be honest, that's true of most games. Like, I watch more movies than I play games, I'd say now. Like, just because, again, like, after a day of interacting with systems, I don't necessarily want to do that for fun. My partner's not a big gamer, so that also is kind of like, that's something we can do together rather than me going and playing a game. So although there are some games that I'm allowed, that are entertaining enough for her to watch, that it's fun. So I don't play enough. I don't think anyone, I think most, like, of the people who are kind of a certain age or up in the games industry feel this way, right? That we don't play enough games.
I think I've played less games since I started working in the industry than ever before.
I'd buy that.
Yeah. And although I don't know if I really, like, deconstruct them. I mean, I think I did when I first started, like, maybe the first 5 years, I would really deconstruct things. Now, I mean, I guess I still have that mind kind of actively running in the background. I usually can let things wash over me. And once in a while, like, things will really jump out of being awesome and I'll be so inspired, and I'll, you know, set up a meeting at work and we'll go during lunch and just, like, play through a game. And I'm like, you got to see this. Like, actually, one example was that strategy game Frostpunk. I was so, like, impressed by the UI in that game and some of the, like, shortcuts, and especially, like, on the console, the way they, because RTS on a console is, like, the holy grail, like, trying to make that work. It's, like, so difficult, and so many games have tried it. And I feel like Frostpunk was, like, a huge leap in terms of the controls. And so, yeah, I set aside a whole, like, hour of, like, you guys got to see what they're doing with Frostpunk. And so I love that. I love, like, seeing a game do something really well, and then I love showing it off to my developer friends and, like, people at work. But for the most part, and I can, you know, maybe another thing that's come out of this is, like, I'm way more forgiving of games because I know, like, how it's really a miracle hard. Anything ever gets made. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, my partner won't watch me play a lot of games, but when she does, she's way more critical of them than I am, because she's like, ooh, that, I don't know, that animation doesn't look very good. I'm like, well, yeah, but it's an open world game. It's got, like, billions of animations in it. So, you know, they did what they could with the time that was there.
Mike, you mentioned watching a lot of movies, and I had read that Thomas Was Alone was originally a chain game. Or chain gang game based on Oh Brother. So sounds like movies are super influential. I mean, obviously John Wick, but movies are super influential for your design.
I guess, like, I think one thing that's nice about movies is that they, weird thing to say, movies are about things, but they're not mechanically about things. So there's I find them, I guess, so a lot of ideas can come from them, because you're seeing, like with the chain gang in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, or all of John Wick, like, you see ideas in there and you're like, I could make a game of that. Like, I guess that's part of what this show's about, right? Like, I think there's I think they can trigger off stuff in that way. But I'm also definitely very cautious about the kind of, I definitely want to make games, not movies, right? So I definitely never want to be kind of too far over the fence. It was interesting spending kind of, 2 years kind of in Hollywood, in the Hollywood machine and world, and you get a little starstruck with it, and you're like, you know what, this is kind of cool. Like, I could get involved with this world.
That's cool.
I definitely always wanted to kind of stay in the game side, but you're right. Like, I think I'm also a big, like, history nerd, and kind of so stuff comes from there. But that's generally, history is just where I steal all my stories from, rather than game design.
Nice. Actually, while we're talking about John Wick,
I loved your podcast on that, by the way. That did the round.
I wanted to bring that up because it was just so funny that, like, I think this started with you. I think you tweeted out something like, hey, how would you make a John Wick game? Is that accurate, or am I misremembering that?
I'm a cheeky bastard, so it's entirely possible I did that while working on a John Wick game. That feels like the kind of thing I would do and then immediately get, like, an email telling me off for doing it. Sounds right. I reckon I did that.
So I think you might have started it, and I think that there was, it kind of started trending and people were talking about it, and then we decided
No, it wasn't me. I've just remembered. It wasn't me. It was a tweet. There was a viral tweet that went around from someone else.
Yes.
another indie developer, okay. and with loads sure. of responses. Yes, because I remember we were reading that, and then your podcast came along, and we all okay. listened to it. Yeah,
got it.
Sorry, I just
so yeah. like we had started banking episodes for this podcast. Like it actually hadn't come out yet. We were recording a few in advance, so we had a little bit of a buffer. And that's when that thing sort of hit, and we're like, hey, we should just jump on right now, record one live. And then release it because we're super. We love John Wick. This is mm-hmm. super into this idea, and the fact that you guys listened to it at all, we were like, "Wow!"
Oh yeah, no. Nick, who was the designer, the main designer on, the developer design mechanic designer, and then we had level designer join him. Steve, Nick sent it around. No, Nick found that very quickly. And like I'd listened, I followed you already, so I'd seen you done it, but it was like on my to yeah. listen to list, and then I saw, yeah, and then yeah. Nick shared it, and it was great fun because you were kind of, if I remember right, there was one of you basically did pitch the game we were making, and then the other one was like, that's terrible, and then pitched basically pistol whip. I can't remember yeah. which way yes. around it yes. was.
It was yeah. it was bullets per minute, which is coming out soon. Was right, essentially which the is one kind that. Of, Matt was pitching in, but Danish, yours was this kind of like one hit, like flourish move heavy game that ended up being yeah, very right. similar to Hex.
It was funny as hell, because you were listening to it and it was just, yeah, it was one of those moments where we realized how cool what we were doing would be to the outside world, because obviously there's the excitement when you start, but then I think we yeah. were like, I feel like we were like 6 months to a year into development at that point. And at that point, it's a job, right? At that point, you're getting the work yeah. done. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of those nice moments of like, there are people who really like to have the problems we're figuring out now. And it's like, yeah. you know, and the just being able to like work with all those people and with the film side as well, and like soak up all that knowledge from the people who work on the movies was amazing.
I mean, I could totally relate to that. Like, any game that you're working on, after a while, it is becomes a job. And then when we release a trailer at E3 yeah. or like reveal the game, it's like you get this huge release of like, oh my God, it just feels so good. It's like finally you get to let the secret out, but also just like you get invigorated by all the response and stuff. And I mean, I don't want to get into this as a side thing, but like that's why it really, really, like leaks really upset me. And mm-hmm. I really hate them because it robs
it
all
of that.
It takes
the team's moment but, away from them a little bit, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Or absolutely, a lot, I guess. Yeah. But actually, so going back real quick to the pistol whip thing, what was your reaction to pistol whip? Because many, many people describe it as like a John Wick game. And it's funny, on our very podcast that we did, there was like, that was one take on it. So what were your thoughts on that?
I loved it. I played Pistol Whip a fair amount. I think it's cool. I like it. In terms of it as a John Wick game, it's obviously, it's not the John Wick game I'd make, because I made the John Wick game
yeah,
I'd
yeah,
make.
Yeah.
But no, it's really cool and it is cool as well. Like, it's a good game, but it's also, I love what they've done with the, like, the aesthetics and the music and all that yeah. sort of things. I think for me, the thing I like about John Wick, because I think they've said with Pistol Whip, the makers, I've met them, and I think they've said this publicly, that like John Wick was one of the inspirations for it, right? Because I actually met them at a party or something, and we were talking about it, because so that's kind of it, we actually had the conversation we're having here where it was like, so this, you know, Pistol Whip is what they did with John Wick, and I did what I did with John Wick. And I think yeah. what's interesting about it is they've really latched on to a lot of the aesthetics of John Wick, which is a really cool aspect of John Wick, and the kind yeah. of the feel of those moments in a very cathartic, kind of energetic way. I got more into the kind of the stunt work choreography side of it, which is where my game right. comes from. So it's I don't think one's more relevant than the other. I think it's just kind of an interesting, it's interesting that we both took away the same thing. And it kind of speaks to what I said about kind of looking to movies for inspiration, is that you can pick out like five different things you like. What's definitely a bad idea yeah. is what I've seen people say about John Wick, which is they should make an open world third person shooter. Like, to me, that's the most worst idea. Like, that doesn't use anything that's good about John Wick. But yeah, no, I hope there's more John Wick games. Like, we weren't the first. There was a VR one done by was it Starbreeze did it? I think it might have been.
It sounds right.
I think they did a VR John Wick game. So we weren't the first. I'm sure we won't be the last. So I'm kind of hyped to see other teams try different things with it and see where it ends up.
Was there a Payday DLC with John Wick.
There was that as well. That's true. Yeah, because that's also Starbreeze. So yeah, they had that relationship, and they did. Yeah, so they did a VR game. They did the Payday thing. He's in Fortnite as well.
Yep.
Which I think, when did that come out? I think that came out right before 3, I think. Yeah.
So that was
nice. In the same kind of zone. So I don't know what's next for the franchise, but I'm hyped to see it. Like
they just announced that they're filming 4 and 5 simultaneously.
Yeah, well they were doing 4. This is the thing where I have to remember like what I know from private conversations and what is like public.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember it was actually one of the genuinely loveliest moments of development was we were doing. So we'd been around while they were making 3, so we'd seen the screenplay before they shot it. I visited Chad while he was editing it. We didn't visit the set, but hung out with him while he was editing. And then we were at the premiere, and so we'd kind of seen the project grow kind of in that way.
Yeah.
And I remember I was actually in Lionsgate's office like the Monday after 3 came out and was phenomenally immediately financially successful. And just the buzz you could feel in the room of like,
oh man,
we get to keep making John Wick, you know, and that was fun.
It's so good.
So I knew there was going to be a 4. I'd not seen the 5 thing. That's really cool. So they're doing it simultaneously.
Yeah. Yesterday or the...
Right, yeah. Back to me.
That makes sense for the franchise as well. Mm-hmm. That makes sense, like, because in terms of you've got that recurring cast, you've got, yeah. That makes a lot of sense from a production point of view. I can see why that would work.
We should move on to the pitch, but I do want to ask one last thing. While we're talking about kind of Pistol Whip and VR, your VR addition or update to Volume was like one of the first kind of VR games. Like this is PSVR early on.
I think we were technically a launch title, although we weren't because it was just a DLC. But I think we launched with the VR on PSVR, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So like, you were so in on the ground floor on that, which is so cool. And now that VR is like pretty huge, like quests are sold out everywhere. Absolutely, it's hard to find. Like, have you thought about going back to VR?
I mean, I continue to play with it. Like, I love it.
Yeah.
For us, it's always been kind of there's a lot of amazing developers who've absolutely like laser focused on VR and are doing awesome stuff. And my rule has always been like, we play with it if we come up with something that we think is like good enough to be in the pantheon of what everyone else is making, we'll take it further. But like, yeah, I got so much respect for the people who do the actual, like, because that's pioneering game design, right? Like the level of,
yeah,
that's amazing stuff. And we're bluntly not at that level, but if we have an idea that's cool and someone wants us to make it, we'll definitely go there.
The, you know, VR has been like mostly and rightfully so like an experiential thing where you are in the shoes of the person, you're looking around, you're picking things up. But there are some games, and I think Volume was maybe one of the first where it's sort of like you're looking down at a diorama on a table.
Yeah, well, I think
I love that style of it too.
Yeah, it was fun to do, and it was because, to be honest, it was one of those conversations. I think it was just a conversation with Sony where Volume was one we were working on. I dug VR, and I think Sony came to us and just said, like, do you see a PSVR way of doing something in that world or whatever? I don't think they expected us to do, like, we wanted to do the kind of, I think we called it internally because there weren't words for these things back then. We were calling it, like, the game board kind of idea of, like, and for us as well, one thing we really wanted to do when we got in there was you can kind of scale it up and down, you can kind of rotate, you can kind of set it up so, like, you know, you want to lie on your back and play it on the ceiling, you can absolutely do that and kind of have that level of comfort. And I think they were kind of surprised with it, but it was fun to put together. And it was a nice opportunity to kind of extend the story of Volume as well. Cause Volume's this weird kind of, it was Robin Hood kind of, but futuristic. It was fun to write for.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was good. I'm proud of that one. That I think that the VR game came out well. But yeah, and a nice, and to be honest, as well as an indie studio, obviously a nice opportunity to, like you say, get in the ground floor of some new tech, play with some new toys.
I have to, like, this must have been inspired by the Metal Gear VR missions.
Metal Gear Solid? I've never heard of it. No, I would never.
It's just so funny that there's a thing called VR missions.
Yeah.
And you guys actually made it a VR mission.
That's the weirdest.
I love that. It's the best.
And it's the most strange experience of my life was we announced, did we announce Volume at Gamescom? Or did we, I think we announced it. as part of the Sony press conference at Gamescom.
Yeah.
And Hideo Kojima was there with he was announcing DLC number 7 for Metal Gear Solid 5 or whatever it was. And when you're, I don't know if you guys have done the on-stage stuff at those kind of events, but like you're just sat in a row backstage, basically behind the screen. So this big screen that's behind the speaker. Yeah. There's just a row of you all in like director's chairs. And because I think it was based on order, but I actually also suspect that some of the guys at Sony were messing with me. I was sat next to Hideo Kojima backstage. So, and you know, we were both sat there and I got to watch Hideo Kojima watch the trailer for Volume. And it was this weird moment of like, and of course I turned and looked at his face. Right?
Yeah.
And there was just there was just that look across his face, I think like 5 seconds in of like, oh, he's ripped off Metal Gear Solid.
He just goes like this.
I don't know if that's what he was thinking, but that's what I intuited into his face of like, oh yeah, cool, okay, I guess, yeah, it makes sense. Someone cloned that, yeah, fair enough.
Grimace, and he's shaking his head violently.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you want for the story, right? You want him to like throw his laptop on the ground and storm out. But no, it was that was weird. Volume was weird because of that Sony relationship. I got to experience some really weird stuff, like in terms of like just that. For someone who just made the Rectangle game, that was a very quick education in kind of larger kind of scale development.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to get into it, but the similar reaction of us, getting some licensed characters and actors scanning for our games, that it's been like a, outside yourself, like looking down, like, oh my god, I grew up on these movies, and now
what's a direct Ian McShane like? I still don't fully believe that happened. Like, it's amazing.
It's amazing.
He did Deadwood quotes for me in the recording booth. It was amazing. Normal.
Actually, you know what? On that topic, I do want to give a shout out to a podcast called Culturally Relevant. You did an interview on that. You talked a lot about what that was like, and I don't want to rehash it here, but I do want people to check out that interview. It's excellent. You can find it at Culturally Relevant. Awesome interview. You talk a lot about Thomas Was Alone and starting it out, and it was phenomenal. So I definitely want people to check that out. All right, let's move on to the pitches. So I've been playing, we didn't really get a chance to talk about it, but one of the games I've been playing is Carry On, that amazing game where you're this like blob, this meat blob with tentacles going around and eating people and doing things. It's really clever. It's really amazing. It feels great, the control of it. And I thought, like, this is something I haven't seen before. I mean, there's games like, Overlord or whatever, where you're playing as the bad guy. But in every game, it's mostly like an aesthetic or like a wrapper over a more traditional game. Whereas, like, this game, I don't think you could ever reskin it to be like, oh no, you're the good guy. You're the good insane spaghetti monster that's eating people. So I was trying to think, like, what other avenues can playing as the bad guy afford game design? And like, what are some cool things you can do if you're playing the antagonist or a monster of some kind? And I know, Jeff, a while back you pitched like a werewolf game and stuff, but specifically like mechanics wise, is there any ideas that come to mind of like kind of blowing this thing wide open? So that was my kind of prompt for today. And anybody can kind of jump in with any ideas they have, and we can kind of, try to form something out of it.
Well, so what's interesting about Carry On to me, besides the meat blob part of it, and what I love about villains in general, like the best villains think they're the good guy, right? That's kind of a cliche, but like they have something they're going towards, and it's just the decisions they make along the way are what make them a villain, even though they're not necessarily trying to believe. Like Carry On, for example, it's just a monster who was creating a lab and he's trying to escape. Like, that seems like, I'm trying to escape this place where they're torturing me. I'm obviously the good guy. And then actually, Mike, in your North Star podcast serial, on one of the episodes, the character Grunk is talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's like episode 4, I think. And the narrator, or his inner monologue, he says, maybe that's what true villainy is, an inability to set yourself back in the right path. And that got me thinking, like, what if there was a mechanic in this game where you're having to make decisions along the way for some sort of goal that to you seems altruistic, but they just get more difficult and more morally gray along the way. And by the end of it, you're obviously a villain, but you kind of morph there over the course of the game. So like some sort of decision making mechanic where it just is more and more difficult to stay good to where you become bad. What do you guys think about that?
I like that. That's kind of, it reminds me of Masquerade Bloodlines, right? With the blood mechanic in that, where like you would, I can't remember exactly how it worked, but it was similar in that you were basically making choices about resource, but if you went too far with it, you would descend into kind of being Nosferatu-style vampire.
Hmm.
That kind of thing? Is that what, like, I guess that's a very, that's kind of the blunter kind of very systemic version of what you're saying, but the idea, I love the idea of like, yeah, where you can kind of descend, this kind of Scorsese sim.
Yeah,
where you can kind of, you don't think of yourself as a bad guy, but through a series of bad choices, you can become that way.
Yeah.
Actually, it's funny that we're talking about Ghost of Tsushima, and that was one criticism I have heard, that the game sets up this duality of this honorable samurai or the ghost, and that the criticism is that it's not really a choice. One, from a meta level of the, like, just the ghost stuff is really fun, and you want to build up, like, you know, stealth stuff, if you, you know, but also the game... just the narrative leads you that way. And I don't know, I haven't gotten that far in it. I haven't beaten it. Jeff, can you speak to, like, I don't want to get off topic, but like, do you think that Ghost handles that duality, or
I think
is it more like a structured narrative?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a structured narrative. And I mentioned before vaguely that like the last two thirds of the game start to deal with that a lot. There's an event that happens right at the end of part one that kind of instigates that narrative arc, and I mean, Mike, you're a little bit ways into that, but it really becomes a nice narrative crescendo. However, mechanically, yeah, there's nothing that happens to you. There's nothing that really affects you other than the weather getting stormier. I think there's been a few articles about how the weather reacts to you, and honestly, it's a subtle thing, and it's not like super, like you're not locking yourself into one weather type or anything. So, yeah, that isn't joined as nicely as it could be, but narratively they at least address it.
It feels like a lampshade, really hard, right? It feels like they realized they'd made a samurai stealth game and that those two issues were massively kind of in opposition to each other.
Well, and mechanically, you can use ghost weapons at any point in combat. It doesn't have to just be stealth. So that line is very blurred mechanically.
Also, if you think back to like the old Mass Effect stuff of like the Renegade Paragon stuff, It's always that, you know, we make fun of the term, but the ludonarrative dissonance of like, well, the game is fun this way, but the narrative is what I want this way. And, you know, few games have that aligned. It's a tough one. I don't know, Dan, like, how do you feel like you would toe that balance between the two? Like, would it be powers that you get, you know, either or like, how do you feel like gameplay wise that would work out?
I mean, I like the whole prompt is to be the bad guy. So I don't know if we necessarily need to even give you the option of the good guy path so much. Maybe it's just how bad you become, or maybe your goal, the only way to go towards your goal is to be bad. And so it'd be something in the narrative that sets up like, okay, here's your goal. Here's the choices you make along the way. Maybe it's something as simple as like, I don't know, you can either knock people out or you can kill them. Killing them is way easier, and if you choose to be good, you're actually getting further from your goal. I don't know.
It doesn't seem like there's a lot of conflict there. Yeah. It's like people are going to want to be bad, and then they're going to be rewarded. And I don't know if there's a
way to bring them back the other way.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the draw for something like this is the ambiguity, where as the player you're not sure what's right and what's wrong. Mm-hmm. And the difference between killing somebody and knocking them out is going to be obvious for the player, and that's where that dissonance comes in. So my head is in a place where I want to find something that isn't good or bad on its surface, and it's all about context or perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like you think Dante's Inferno, right? He's descending into hell and, you know, eventually, you know, coming face to face with the devil. But if you just look at that literally upside down, he's ascending into heaven and killing God, right? Like, that's a matter of perspective. And that doesn't have anything to do with the second-to-second mechanic of Dante's Inferno, but it's all a matter of perspective. Hmm. So maybe there's something there.
You guys are taking this thing way too highbrow.
I was going to say, my ideas are much more gross than this.
Yes, exactly. My takeaway was like, man, what's some like gnarly shit I want to
So yeah. I had an idea, if you'll allow me, of just something like super basic. You know, you think about Resident Evil and you think about like the giant fleshy monster with like the NPC, you know, in this kind of eye socket in the middle. And I was thinking, like, how do you get there? And so I was thinking about being a flesh monster, not to borrow too much from Carrion, but being a flesh monster and having this room, this big, empty kind of cathedral-like space where it's just you in the middle and you're small. And what you do is you have all these kind of fodder enemies around you, and you infect one with a little flesh slug, and they go out into the dungeon that the hero is traveling through. But because you're just a little fodder enemy, you're actually in a stealth game where you're avoiding the hero while you're collecting the fleshy body parts of enemies that the hero has destroyed and bringing them back to this flesh lump, where you build yourself into this giant flesh monster. And so the, you know, finale is almost like a tower defense thing where the heroes finally come and you're face to face with them. And now you have to use your fleshy blobbiness to destroy them.
Okay.
That feels a little more literal.
Yeah.
Yes. Much more satisfying to me.
So sorry to bring the highfalutin stuff into it. I apologize.
I was thinking, like I said, what are some cool powers? And I was thinking like T-1000 or like in the X-Files, there was like the alien guy who's kind of like a shapeshifter. Basically, the idea of a shapeshifter power. And like... not to give too much away, but there's that HBO show, The Outsider, that has a little bit of this going on. And it's this, so the idea is this creature that has to feed, and it has this ability to like absorb DNA and then take on the form of people, or like, you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, obviously, like this doppelganger thing is a staple of horror sci-fi. And what can we do with that? And I was thinking like, well, Hitman already does it. You know, Hitman, you can knock someone out, take their clothes. So, like, what's the supernatural take on Hitman that gives you more power, that gives you more, like... I don't know, that's kind of where my head was at. I don't know if that sparked anything.
So I was actually thinking a very similar kind of vein with mine. I was thinking kind of, yeah, like, The Thing, basically, was kind of where I started. Yeah. But what interested me... with the Hitman thing, because I also went to like, well, that's obviously Hitman's where you go with that. I think what's interesting with Hitman and where I think the kind of the fantasy of like body snatcher or whatever it kind of comes from is manipulation of people. In Hitman, you don't really manipulate people. You can kind of trigger things off, or you can get past people, or you can basically press a trigger scripted event button in some way or other, right? I'm wondering if there's something about kind of social manipulation, gaslighting, like just
absolutely
evil kind of manipulation of the group. There was a game based on The Thing that came out like PS2 era, right?
Where and it was really good.
It was really good, where you were basically playing as one of the humans, and you would, and it was always this kind of paranoia about who is the thing and what's going on in the game messed with you. But I wonder if that from the other side of like actively trying to like Hitman, but you have to live with them. Like Hitman, but you have to kind of be embedded for longer periods. Not just going to a place and doing a thing in kind of a traditional video game way. More of kind of you have to be an NPC in a Sims house. You have to kind of mess with people, exist long term in that space, manipulate them into doing things. Yeah,
it reminds me of that scene in Terminator 2 when the T-1000 calls John Connor on the phone, posing as his stepmom.
That was an impression.
It was really good. It was spot on.
Thank you.
Exactly what you were doing.
And the whole thing about the dog, like when you know Arnold asks him, like, you know, is Wolfie okay or whatever, and then it's like, oh yeah, Wolfie's fine, and that's the you know trick to see if she knows the dog's name. Like, yeah, all that social manipulation stuff. That's amazing. I love that.
It reminds me of God Will Be Watching, where that's kind of the opposite, right? Because you're trying to mediate situations in that game. Mm. But I wonder like what kind of new take you can have on that with this idea of social manipulation. Because I instantly think, you know, kind of episodic conversation tree, narrative driven, where you start one day and you're kind of dealing with the same group of people over the period of time, but you know maybe there's some sort of external instigator that's applying pressure to the group that you can play off of or work around.
And also, how about this? You got you have a a hint of Octodad, where as you start, like, maybe your human form starts to wear away after a while, and certain, like, alien grotesque features start to come out, and you have to, like, hide them. Like, you start wearing hats a lot, and everyone's like, "Oh, you never wore a hat before." I'm like, "No, I'm getting into hats now." And then maybe, like, you know, your arms start bending backwards, and you have to sort of, like, still act human across this, like, physical space too, not only just the psychological stuff. I mean, that's just a silly take.
I kind of like that, though. Like, I like the idea that you're living in, you're kind of embedded in this group, and you're collecting information to use against them, right? So, like, early game, it's almost like the little blob that you were talking about, Jeff, is early game is about gathering information and, like, figuring out how you can manipulate everybody. And then maybe there's some sort of, like trust, or Quarantine Circular had a trust, like, a literal trust meter.
I was gonna say, like, this might be the third circular game we're designing here.
But characters trust you more or less depending on a couple of factors. One is how sensically are you talking to them. Like, if they ask about Wolfie and there's no Wolfie, then they're gonna trust you less. But also, how degraded is your form, or how, like, weird are you moving because you're slowly turning back into a monster? So those things could all play off each other too.
I'm just picturing, like, a Mrs. Doubtfire moment where you got to stick your face in the cake to try to.
That's gonna tank your trust meter.
I can also see it. You'd have to come up with the right setting as well, because you want somewhere where people are. You don't want an environment filled with nice people, because there's not going to be it. Everyone's just going to immediately kind of turn on you or try and figure you out. You almost want a combative environment generally. Like, if it wasn't like a horror thing, I'd say like high school, right? Like, it's that kind of thing. But you can almost imagine that with politicians, or with kind of, I'm trying to think of an environment where there would be some antagonism and some kind of jockeying
I
for position anyway.
That works with that.
Okay.
I think I have something that works with that, and it might be too topical. But I'm
scared.
And this borrows a little bit from the thing too, but what if it's a cruise ship, right? Like, I mean, today cruise ships and outbreaks, like, there's a correlation. And the benefit of a cruise ship is that you have a very wide range of people and a very wide range of personality types all in one confined space.
Sure. Yeah. And you're also sort of, like, isolated, you're trapped. Like, maybe the third act is like, okay, you cannot hide this anymore. You have to make your move. And then now it just becomes this bloodbath. Or, you know, and people can't escape.
What if this is the Titanic and there never was an iceberg? There was just you.
Ooh.
Oh, shit. The true story of Titanic. Oh, my God.
I like the third act of you finally have to make your move. And then where all the first and second act stuff comes about is... how trusting are people of each other, and how willing are they to work together?
That's the one. That's interesting. Yeah. Like, how they factioned up, what have you managed to...
Yeah, if you've sown enough... between them. Yeah, exactly. If you've sown enough distrust amongst them, they're all going to, like, say, well, we should split up and go to separate rooms and be by ourselves. And then it's easy for you to...
Yeah, that third act is basically, it's like a cabin in the woods style situation, right?
Yes.
Like, it plays out a simulation, essentially, of a slasher movie. That would be cool.
Yeah, that would be cool.
I really like that.
That's great. I remember, like, you know, we talk about this a lot on the podcast too, where we like games where you set it up and the game knocks it down. And that's totally what this is. Like, I love the idea of maybe the third act, you don't play it. Like, you just, okay, I've done all the legwork, and then let's see what happens. And you let loose. And I mean, obviously it would be fun to rip people apart and stuff and actually do it. But I love that. I love the idea of this just... The legwork. You're doing the mundane sort of day-to-day legwork of this master plan of taking down this ship or whatever. It's the stuff that you don't usually focus on in video games, like the groundwork, you know? Yeah.
I think there's just something inherently interesting about examining people and groups of people in this kind of microcosm environment. You know, thinking about trust and distrust, the way that we interact with people day to day, you know, you hear a secret from a friend and you're entrusted to that, but like another friend might really benefit from that information, or you might benefit from somebody else knowing that information. And there's almost something very down to earth about this whole thing, even though the context, of course, is escalating. But I'm just curious, like, what, like, how does a conversation tree look in this game? Because I feel like, you know, the overall gestalt of, you know, sowing discord and then becoming a monster and tearing everybody apart is perfect. But like, what is that, you know, round one look like, I guess?
I think it would be like convincing. So for example, let's say you want this person to give you a key because that key will unlock certain things, let you access some whatever. Like it could be a chain of events. And I think each thing would just come down to like, maybe you make up a story of why you need that key. Mm-hmm. And if that story, if checks out, it's like, if they believe you, then they'll give it to you. Or so I think it's the nitty gritty of it would be just be like having a conversation and trying to convince them of a thing or convince them to let you do something or convince them that that person is not to be trusted.
Mm-hmm. I think so it becomes like,
I was going to say, it's like juggling lies where like you told this one person one thing and now you're talking to another person. And it has to line up somehow.
And you have to make sure they don't talk to each other somehow. Yeah.
I think I'd pull it back. I think the way I do it is it's something that I've done. I did a GDC talk on Subsurface actually because I took like a very level design focused approach in the Subsurface circular kind of conversation system, which is cool, but it's kind of linear and it does have its limitations. With this, I kind of feel like I'd go for a much more systemic approach. So I'd map the hierarchy. Mm. I'd take the group, 20 people. Okay, this is the cool kid. He is looked up to by these two people. These three people are in a love triangle. This person's currently the favorite. And I'd say, well, what you can then do is maybe you can deliberately trigger conversations to mess with connections. Hmm. So you can go, I want those two people to stop looking up to the cool guy. So I'm going to do a destructive conversation with each of them to try and diminish him in their estimation and kind of end up with some kind of updating kind of hierarchy where you can kind of remap. To me, the fantasy of this is messing with the organ. Maybe this is saying a lot about how awful a person I am.
It's seeding chaos.
It's the messing with the structure of the relationships is the fun bit. To me, the kind of telling the lie or getting the dog's name right, that to me doesn't feel as much as that's not the bit that's interesting to me. That's something I want in there, but I kind of that's your sword fight. That's not your meta game. And I think I think you could pull that kind of around that systemic thing.
Yeah.
How you would do that and how you would manage the production of that content, I have no idea.
That's for someone else to worry about. Worry we're about just that the idea
people. No, that's the easy part. I mean, we're doing the hard
team
part.
Will
that's
do
the
that.
Yeah, if you take that to a literal level, like you could have a straight up map, right? Of like,
I was going to say, double jeopardy for this show, flowchart. Like that's our special button that you just pressed.
Yeah.
No, we've talked about this before with Outer Wilds. I mean, Outer Wilds does an amazing flowchart for its quests trees and stuff. So yeah, it could be as literal as that, or maybe the first step is to determine what that is, so that you can then
Act one is building the chart. Act two is tearing it apart, and Act three is literally tearing all the people apart.
Like social form of war that you're trying to get through. Yeah. You're trying to figure it out. That's nice. Yeah. I like that a lot. Because that requires inquiry, which is going to lead to nice world building. It gives the player a reason to. It's the reason Subsurface Circle why you're a detective, because detectives are a character who can ask questions and no one thinks that's weird. Mm-hmm. It's a classic world building trick to make your protagonist a detective. I like that. So you're figuring it out, but you're also trying to hide the fact that you're trying to figure it out. Right. It's an interesting wrinkle, right?
Yeah,
it's clever.
This is amazing. Yeah. I think someone should make this.
Oh, and then at the end, you realize you're the bad guy. Just, you know, going back to the original idea that I brought up was
you look in the mirror and like you're like, oh my god, what have I done?
Yeah, it's Mean Girls. We've designed Mean Girls. That's what we've done.
You're there, and you know you're this flying spaghetti monster hovering over the icy waters of the Arctic, and you look down into the water where the Titanic used to be, and the waters become still, and there for just a moment in the starlight, you see yourself for what you truly are.
Paint a picture, man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, on that note, let's wrap it up. But before we do, you guys have any recommendations of anything cool you've checked out recently, anything you've watched or played that you want to shout out to people? I'll start. I watched a thing on Netflix called The Speed Cubers. It's a really quick documentary. It's like, I think, only 40 minutes. And it's about championship Rubik's Cube solving, where people will like solve in under 7 seconds and there's like a world championship. Now, here's the thing about this. On its face of it, I think it's a great idea for a documentary. I'm fascinated by subculture. I love seeing these people do it, being really, really good at something. But this thing is amazing because I was basically crying the whole time I was watching this.
Wow.
Because it's a beautiful story of humans connecting with each other, and basically the best speed cuber in the world and the second best speed cuber in the world have a beautiful, heartwarming relationship. And God, it's just so uplifting. It's so fulfilling. And I can't recommend it higher. It's Speed Cubers on Netflix, and it's going to make you cry.
Awesome.
I'm going to jump in with a TV show that I'm convinced I'm the only person in the world that watches, which is the Get Shorty TV show. Do you guys watch that, or have you watched
it? No, I have heard of it. I love Chris O'Dowd, and I like Get Shorty the movie.
I don't think anyone watches it other than me.
I really wanted to. It's on my list.
It's really good. The third series kind of... If you're into it, it's great, but like it definitely, the third series is not the strongest, but like it is Entourage meets Breaking Bad, and it should not work. and yet it does. And yeah, Chris O'Dowd's amazing. I don't know how much it was, again, I feel like I've harped on about this too much, but like being someone who has been the outsider in Hollywood in the last few years, like I don't know how much it was just like noticing the jokes about how much people bring you water and stuff. Like I don't know if it was like it was just too specific, but like no, it's genuinely fantastic. Like it's a weird idea executed fascinatingly. It does, like I said, third series goes off the rails a little bit, but like one and two just genuinely thoroughly entertaining, surprisingly well written. I don't know how it works. I don't know how you make Breaking Bad meets Entourage and pull it off.
Where are you watching it?
I think in the US it's on... Is it on Stars? I think in the US. Whereas okay. In the UK it's on... in the UK it's on Sky, but within right. The UK basically everything ends up on one channel. That's yeah. How it...
I was going to say it's actually, either BBC or it's Sky, right?
Exactly. You got like BBC, Sky, or I guess now Netflix as well, obviously. So right. It soaks up the rest. Yeah.
Actually, speaking of British TV, are you watching Gangs of London?
I watched the first episode and loved it. Like, yeah. Genuinely loved it. And I watched the second episode and I hated it. And I've, wow.
Really?
I've gone off it. I think what it... The first one felt genuinely like someone trying to do, like, a gangster show, but, like, Shakespeare. Like, it felt epic. And I think yeah. What I realized when I watched the second episode is I just like a few of the actors. So I went and watched a bunch of... So genuinely, like, the... what's the name? The best friend of... Miles O'Brien is like who's now running the gang. He I was like, this guy's phenomenal. I'd not seen him in much stuff. And I realized he was in the Royal Shakespeare Company for a year. So there's a load of him playing all the great Shakespeare roles. So I was like, oh, I'll just watch those. I like him. Does it get better? Is my criticism like very specific, maybe?
I think that the second episode is a little bit it gets better, I guess.
Okay.
I would stick with it. I'd give it at least another episode, maybe, three. Yeah, watch episode three, maybe four. I think it kind of levels out and becomes its own thing and finds its voice. Mm-hmm. The first two episodes are maybe a slightly discordant with each other. Like, they don't really flow, but yeah. I think I've only seen like half of it, but I love it. I think it's great. And
it's a really surprisingly fresh retelling of an incredibly cliche story, right?
Like, exactly.
It's the same.
Yeah.
You've definitely seen it before, but like the way they do it, the cast's fantastic.
Yeah. I was a huge fan of The Raid, and I actually was not a huge fan of The Raid 2 because I just didn't think they quite nailed the Godfather.
Too much into.
Yeah. There were so many fight scenes that my face went blank, like just watching it, like I zoned out. But even apart from that, like the Shakespearean Godfather type stuff, I thought they didn't quite nail it. It was almost there, but I do think they nailed it in Gangs of London. So unfortunately, you can't really watch that in the US. We happened to watch it just because we found this DVD lying on the street and we just picked it up and it was Gangs of London.
It's so innocent. You can't help that.
Yeah, no, you can't help it. But so there's officially no official way to watch it in the U.S. But there's no way Netflix U.S. is not going to pick this up, or something's not going to pick this up. It's just too good. But.
I think the second season's already been greenlit, so I think that's rolling.
Oh wow,
nice.
Yeah. Awesome. Dan, you got anything?
Yeah, mine sounds incredibly mundane next to your guys's, but. There's a new iOS app by Zach Gage, who's obviously super well known, and I'm sure a lot of people have already heard of this, but it's just a good Sudoku. It's just a Sudoku app, which I normally am not big into, but it's kind of been my morning like zen to kind of ease myself into 2020 every day. and it does a really good job of there's lots of different, there's like dailies that you can do. There's also different ways to play where there's like an arcade mode where you have like three lives. And if you do something wrong, you lose a life. So you don't get like 30 minutes in and realize it's impossible anymore. And then it teaches you a lot of the techniques along the way, which have like lots. I don't know if Zach came up with these names or if these are actual names of Sudoku techniques, but it's like, well, you got to look for the hidden split, or you have to look for the Y-wing, or you have to look for the square dance. I don't know. I haven't got all the way through it, but it's just really, really well made, well designed. And if you want to get deep into Sudoku or even just like play a little in the morning, it's been really good. So I recommend that.
I want to recommend something off that. It's a YouTube video. So there's channels where like they solve Sudoku live, and
I know where you're going. I know where you're going.
I think it's called the Miracle Sudoku. It's basically a Sudoku board with like two numbers, and it's like impossible. And like the guy, but there's some specific rules that are like additional to the normal Sudoku rules. This guy watched, you know, you watch this guy thinking, well, this is a joke. No one can solve this. It's like, okay, well, let me see. Oh, like maybe this works. And over the course of, you know, like whatever, 15, 20 minutes, he solves it. And it's just a beauty of mathematics and reasoning. And it's an amazing YouTube video. So definitely check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes. Jeff, what about you?
Yeah, so mine's not media at all this week, which is a departure, I feel like, from everything else we do. But one of the big, I don't know if you call it a headache or drawbacks of quarantine, is the limits on food. You know, you're not mm-hmm. going out to restaurants, you're not trying new things necessarily. And so one really big push that we've made in our house is trying new recipes as often as possible. Oh yeah,
same here.
And so we found a website, there's a cookbook associated with it too, but it's called Half Baked Harvest. And I would say 96% of the recipes we've tried have been phenomenal. Really, really tasty food, pretty simple, usually only about 20 or 30 minutes prep cook time. But it's made quarantine so much more bearable. And so during the week we'll do that, and then we'll order in on the weekends. But that's my first one. Second one is a future reco. Apparently, Matthew McConaughey is writing a memoir, and I read about this, it wouldn't be noteworthy except that, you know, there was the McConaissance recently. Yeah. But there's this quote, and I want to do it with a really bad Matthew McConaughey impression because I think it's important.
Okay, go ahead.
But this is the pull quote that I read about. You see, we don't like the red and yellow lights because they take up our time, right? But when we realize that they are all eventually turning green, that's when they reveal their rhyme. That's when life's a poem and we start getting what we want and what we need at the same time. And I call that the honey hole, a little place called heaven on earth. So if that's any indication, indication of how good this memoir is going to be, I will be pre-ordering it as soon as it's available.
It needs to be an audiobook. That's all I need.
Yes. Oh my God.
And if he won't do it, you should.
Yeah, that was like a decent, too kind. Decent McConaughey impersonation. I'm impressed.
That was pretty good.
Pretty good.
Pretty good. I struggle with the Texas accent despite my year and a half down here, but I'm getting better. Yeah.
On the food thing real quick, I never do this, but I made a little tasty style YouTube-y recipe video on how to make Turkish eggs. And I'm really proud of it. It turned out pretty fun. So
yeah, check it out. I can vouch for that. It's a good video.
Yeah, it was fun to make. I might even do more because it was enjoyable. All right, well, we've gone pretty long. Thank you to Mike Bithell for joining us. That was a total blast. Amazing. And, you know, our royalty fees for when you make this game won't be too high. Trust me, it'll be pretty reasonable.
That's reasonable. So, yeah, that's reasonable.
So anything you want to plug or like where people can find you online?
I would love it if people who are listening to this, they're obviously, if you listen to this, you're a fan of fine podcasts. North Star Rising, I'm really proud of. That's a little audiobook we did. Which came together quite nicely in the end, which is cool. And then I guess John Wick Hex is the most recent game we released, so go play that.
Yeah, and then I can vouch for both of those. Amazing. Yeah, definitely check them out. And that'll do it for this week's episode of Someone Should Make This. Thanks for listening. You can always tweet at us at MakeThisPodcast, and it would help us out if you gave us a rating on iTunes.
If you have any comments, a game idea of your own, or think one of our ideas already exists, email us at someoneshouldmakethispodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you to Mariachi Entertainment System for letting us use their music for our theme song. You can hear more of their music at mariachimes.com.
Until next week, we've done the hard part.
Now someone should make it.